being in this lower position here because of my foot, but it's easier than hopping while I'm talking. I wanted to say that last year I had the privilege in the summertime of hearing Dr. Hatcher in Lou Helen speak about moral development, and the subject of these 2 days is moral and social development. And he was part of an institute in St. Petersburg that was working on this whole issue. And a number of very talented people were working with him on it, and he had shared some of that information at the course that I was at. I was really, really excited by a lot of the concepts, and I actually, over the past year, tried to put several of them to test. And really trying to think deeply and apply them to situations. And they certainly bore out to be true, and I was excited by the results of that. And the Mary and Jack Baha'i Institute invited Bill to come here and take part in a week-long school, which we're now having at this time. And I would say that there's the subject... I think what is fascinating is that the subject that we're going to deal with is one that is of course affecting the whole world. And many of you heard that the United Nations had done this study that tried to determine why so much was spent on aid and so little had been accomplished. And the committee at the end of their investigation had concluded that what was really missing was there was a lack of moral leadership. So the whole issue of moral leadership and social development has become a really fundamental issue, and there are people working on it really all over the planet, and I think the Baha'is are really trying to contribute to that whole area, and I know that that's been a focus for Dr. Hatcher's work up to now. For those of you who don't know Dr. Hatcher, he was at Laval University as a mathematics professor in Quebec City, and he retired from that and has been pioneering in Russia now for a number of years, and is serving on the National Spiritual Assembly of the Baha'is of Russia, which we have a really wonderful little picture of here for those of you who would like to see it. And he's also an invited professor working with the Steklov Institute of Mathematics, and especially it's in the research area, so that's where his work is taking him now, and he's still developing and working very hard on this whole issue of moral and social development. So I'm really excited that he could be here, and I think that we'll find this a very stimulating occasion. So please welcome Bill Hatcher.
All right.
No.
Well, I appreciate Gordon's introduction. I appreciate the invitation. I'm just as happy to find anybody who's willing to listen to me as I am to be listened to. I hope that we can address some substantial issues and not remain on the surface. And I would like to start by putting what I see is the following fundamental paradox of Baha'i experience, which is the following fact. We know from the writings of the faith that the Baha'i faith is the most powerful force that has ever come into human affairs. I can elaborate on that in a few minutes if we want. I'm presuming that you've all read these passages from the dispensation of Baha'u'llah, where Shoghi Effendi tells us, for example, that the Baha'i revelation is the greatest revelation, single revelation, that will ever come to this planet. It is greater than all past revelations because it is the transition from childhood to adulthood in the life of humanity. And it is likewise, as he says, greater than all, nor will future ages see its equivalent. Because once you've achieved the transition to maturity, then you don't need as much energy to maintain. In other words, it's the transition from one phase of a system to another phase of the system that takes the energy. Once you've reached a kind of a plateau, another level, then it takes less energy to maintain this level. Just as it took less energy to maintain the lower levels before the transition. And if we compare, well, let's just take the statement that if knowledge is 20 and 4 letters, that all of the revelations from Adam to through Muhammad revealed two of these letters, and the Bab revealed the other 22 letters. And the Bab in the Bayan says that the revelation of Baha'u'llah, that is him whom God shall make manifest, is infinitely greater than his revelation. And his revelation represents 22 24ths, okay, 11 twelfths of the sum of all human knowledge. And Baha'u'llah's revelation is infinitely greater than that. Or look at the time span involved. Jesus' ministry lasted for 3 years. We have only fragmentary accounts of 18 days of his life. The Quran of Muhammad, which as Shoghi Effendi says, is the only surely authenticated holy book. He doesn't say that the Bible is not authenticated. He said it is not surely authenticated, which is just simply reflecting the known scholarship on the issue. Whereas the Quran is surely authenticated. We know that it's authentic. Other parts of the Bible may or may not be authentic. We don't know because there have been so much interpolation, copying, and so on. All of the problems with ancient manuscripts. Well, the Quran of Muhammad, as we know, is a very dense, a very powerful, a very complex book. But, and Muhammad's ministry lasted 40 years, and the Quran was revealed over the period of this 40-year ministry. But if we look at the volume of the Quran, it is not even as big as, say, the Bayani Farsi of the Bab, and that's only one of the Bab's books. But to give some idea of the quantity of revelation, there is currently over 2,000 pages of writings of Baha'u'llah published in English, and there exist in the archives in Haifa 40,000 manuscript pages of the writings of Baha'u'llah that have yet to be published in any language. 40,000 manuscript pages. So it is literally, as Baha'u'llah characterized it, an ocean of revelation, a continual outpouring. If we look at the length of the ministry, we can say that the revelation began with the declaration of the Bab in 1844 and was closed with the death of Abdu'l-Bahá in 1921. So again, we have a ministry that endured, about 80 years. A combined ministry of the Bab, Baha'u'llah, and Abdu'l-Bahá. So these are a few of the indications of the relative power of the Baha'i revelation. It is literally, not in any metaphoric or symbolic sense, it is literally the most powerful thing that has ever existed on this planet. Now, I spoke in the beginning of a paradox, and the paradox is this. How could such a powerful thing exist and go unnoticed by the majority of mankind? How could such a powerful thing exist and even most of us Baha'is do not feel this power or recognize this power. How is such a thing possible? How is it possible that this thing is so powerful and yet so few Baha'is have been able to transform their lives significantly? All of the problems we know we have in the Baha'i community, I won't give you the litany of the things, the different problems we discuss about the divorce rate in the Baha'i community and everything. The fact is that Baha'is clearly suffer all of the ills, I mean, in various degrees, all of the ills that afflict the whole of mankind afflict also the Baha'is. Not necessarily to the same degree or whatever, but in other words, we can't claim or we do not observe that the Baha'i community is anyway sort of magically protected from all of these mental, social, psychological, physical ills, moral ills that afflict the majority of mankind. We have no special status on this score. So how is it then that such a powerful thing can exist and be completely ignored by the vast majority of mankind and be so little understood or so little used by even the Baha'is, even those who have recognized that this power exists? So this is what I call the central paradox of Baha'i experience, and I think that if we do not reflect on this paradox, if we do not find the answer to it, then our faith is going to be extremely weak, because at some point we're going to say, well, it's all a dream. In other words, that at some point we'll say, well, you know, maybe it isn't all this powerful thing. I mean, maybe it's just a bunch of writings by this guy in the Middle East 100 years ago, and fine, okay, there's 40,000 manuscript pages and everything, but, you know, where is all this power? He talks about the power, but where is it, you know? So, in other words, unless we understand very deeply what is going on here, it's quite possible that our faith can be severely challenged, because we can lose faith, if you will, lose confidence in the existence of this power. In other words, one can simply come to the apparently logical conclusion, if this power is so little apparent, then maybe it doesn't exist. In other words, maybe it's just an imagined thing. Maybe it doesn't really exist objectively, this power, or whatever. Well, of course, the logical answer to the paradox is the fact that, yes, this power does exist, it is the most powerful thing, but the deployment of this power, the actualization of this power, has been made conditional by God on certain actions, certain attitudes, for our own good. In fact, because it is so powerful, because it is, in fact, so incredibly powerful, this unimaginable power, that if we had easy access to this power, we would misuse it. Even the best of us would misuse it, as some of the best of us have misused it. I'm speaking, of course, of covenant breakers, for example. As you know, if you've read Tahir Zadeh's book on the covenant, that that some of the leading Baha'is from the very beginning, the close associates of Baha'u'llah, I'm not speaking just about the family of Baha'u'llah, but some of the really lions in the faith, the man, I've forgotten his name, who was chained to Baha'u'llah in the Sea of Chal, became a covenant. Well, Mirza Akajan, his amanuensis for 40 years, became a covenant breaker, and so on and so on. So we see that the possibility of the misuse of this power is not a hypothetical possibility. It is something which has occurred and which is occurring and which undoubtedly will occur in the future. So that's one part of the answer. That's one part of the answer, namely that if we had easy access, if we had casual access to this power, if we could just turn it on and off like you turn on and off a faucet, then we would, in the first place, not respect, we would not realize how great the power is. In other words, it would become a common thing, just like we know when we think about it that, well, yes, radio and TV are very impressive things, but I mean, they become very everyday when you can just turn a knob and get a perfect picture of something that's half a world away and all of this, you know, from all different angles. You know, then pretty soon you stop to think, well, isn't this really incredible that I can sit here in my living room and, you know, get a perfect, absolutely perfect picture of something that's going on halfway around the world. I mean, it's incredible. And that such a thing didn't even exist 100 years ago, and in fact didn't exist during all the 6,000 years of the Adamic cycle. And then all of a sudden, and the principles on which a television works have always existed, so nothing has changed. It's simply that we have recently discovered how to relate to these laws in a certain way that allows us to use them. So this powerful thing, which is the transmission of physical images over unlimited distances, I mean, after all, we get them from space, we get them from the moon, from Mars, and everything else, right? So this powerful thing, which is the instantaneous transmission of physical images over vast distances, that's a very powerful thing, right? An extraordinarily powerful thing. It has always existed. That power has always been there. You know, so if you wanted to use a historical argument, you could say, well, look, for 6,000 years we didn't have this thing, so we're certainly not going to have it tomorrow, right? But in fact, there was a day when you did have it tomorrow. I mean, literally, historically speaking, it was from one day to the next that this technology became known and exploited. And yet, nothing in reality changed. Nothing in objective reality changed. The principles upon which a television works, or an internal combustion engine works, or whatever, always existed, as Abdu'l-Bahá says. Man brings them from the invisible world to the visible world. But they always existed objectively in the invisible world. So it's the same thing with the faith. The faith exists as an entity. It has objective existence. This power exists objectively. It is not a subjective thing. It's not an imagined thing. Its existence is in no wise contingent on our knowledge of its existence. I mean, even if not one single person on earth ever recognized Baha'u'llah, the faith would still be just as powerful as it is. Okay? This power is an objective thing. It is not subjective. It is not subjective. This is something we can discuss philosophically later on if you're interested in. Some Baha'is have seized on the subjectivism that is currently raging in circles of thought as kind of an opening to the Baha'i faith. But this, in my view, is an entirely wrong direction. And I'm a thoroughgoing Platonist, and as a matter of fact, Abdu'l-Bahá, as we can discover if we read the Tablet to the Universe and a few other things, was himself a thoroughgoing Platonist. But of course, Baha'u'llah tells us that Plato got his ideas from the prophets of God that had come before. So the Baha'i faith then is this powerful thing. This power exists objectively, but access to this power is conditional. We only have access to this power if we fulfill certain conditions. And so learning how to be a Baha'i, learning how to act morally, learning how to be moral, learning how to spiritualize our lives, making spiritual progress. Call it whatever you want. It's all of these things that are really connected to the same thing. Spiritual growth, spiritual development, spiritualization, deepening, spiritual progress, moral development, intellectual development, social development, integration, harmony, unity, love, justice. All of these things are conditional on the fulfillment of certain conditions, or it depend on the fulfillment of certain conditions. So it's not conditioned on condition. Depend on the fulfillment of certain conditions. It is conditional access. And so spiritual development then means learning how to gain access to this power. That's what it means. It means nothing less than that. It means learning how to gain access to this power. So the process is, at first you have to know that the power is there. I mean, so you have to go through the process of finding the manifestation, believing in the manifestation, implementing his laws, and so on. As it says in the first paragraph of the Kitab Yahdas. But we want to understand more deeply about what this process is. Now, what we will find is that not only, it is not just that we Baha'is don't understand the Baha'i faith, it is that mankind in general does not understand religion, because mankind has made religion into something other than it intrinsically is. And so we participate in this misunderstanding in the way we relate to the Baha'i faith. And so therefore we do not succeed in fulfilling these conditions. In order to fulfill these conditions that gives us access to this power, we have to first know what the conditions are. We have to first understand them. I mean, we may have another process once we understanding of fulfilling, striving to fulfill them, but we have to at least understand them in the first place, what these conditions are. Well, so what is religion? What is religion? Well, I imagine that most of us would say that, well, religion is a set of beliefs about God, or a set of moral principles based on beliefs about God, or whatever. This is the conception of religion as an ideology. There is also the conception of religion as a society, as a social entity. Look at it. Hi, how are you? Look at it. Let's think about the discourse of teaching the faith. We Baha'is know that our first duty as Baha'is is to teach the faith, and the first duty of the teacher is to teach his own self. So let's look at our discourse about teaching the faith, because this will reflect what our conception of religion is. Well, in North America, when we talk about teaching the faith, what do we talk about? We talk about methods of teaching. We talk about closing the deal. The faith is viewed essentially as a product which we are selling. The language of teaching the faith is the language of salesmanship. And we concentrate, as salesmen do. I mean, the product is already defined. The product is the faith, whatever that is, all right? And we're trying to sell the product. We're trying to close the deal. And so we have contract cards that we, you know, give out to people and so on, and we try to get them to sign the contract and to buy the product, so to speak, and so on. In fact, some of you may very well remember that Hand of the Call, John Robarts, was professionally an insurance salesman, and he used to very effectively talk about teaching the faith, using very deliberately the language of salesmanship. He used to use examples from selling insurance in terms of teaching the faith. Of course, John Robarts did other things like pioneering to Africa under very difficult conditions, and saying the long obligatory prayer, and did a lot of other things which may have had something to do with his success other than the fact that he was a seller of insurance. You can look at all the successful insurance salesmen who are not very good Baha'is, and so one can understand that maybe it wasn't the fact that he sold insurance that made John Robarts a Hand of the Call. Nonetheless, he used this language of salesmanship as a vehicle to express spiritual ideas, but perhaps some of us have taken the language and not gotten the underlying spiritual idea involved. But, of course, I'm not attributing this only to John Robarts. The language of salesmanship is the language of life, of culture in North America. I mean, the whole of North America is one vast bazaar, right? One vast, what? Either way you want. Both ways again. So, I mean, every day we are told that this is a capitalistic society, a free market, a market economy, in which the value of everything depends on selling it, getting somebody to buy it. So, this is de facto. I mean, I'm not trying to ascribe to you any beliefs that you don't have. I'm just saying, I'm looking at the behavior, okay? I'm just looking at the behavior. And I'm saying, the de facto way we articulate teaching the faith is the language of salesmanship. And this is bound to reflect, to some extent, the way we look at the faith as an entity, as a social entity, which we are contracted to. In Europe, the faith is viewed primarily as an ideology in which you believe. In other words, Europeans are used to ideologies. The great ideologies of the last 500 years have all been developed in Western Europe. Protestantism, Marxism, and so on and so on. Fascism, all the isms, all the great ideologies of the modern world were originated in Western Europe, which had this, inherited this dialectical philosophical tradition from the Greeks. It also took the form without the substance from this heritage. And therefore, when you cut this ideology loose from its spiritual moorings that you find in, say, the works of Aristotle or Plato or Socrates, then what you get is Hegelianism or Nietzsche or any of these destructive philosophies which can, in fact, justify anything, literally anything. So anti-Semitism as an ideology, not as an attitude, but as an ideology, was originated in Europe, and so on and so on. Racism is a European ideology. I'm talking about the ideology, the theory, if you will, that some races are superior to others, was originated very explicitly by several European philosophers in the 18th, 19th century, of which one, unfortunately, was the guy who is the guy, Gobineau, the Comte de Gobineau, who wrote first about the Babi faith in his book, Les Religions et les Philosophies de l'Asie Centrale, which E.G. Brown says was his spur to studying the Babi Baha'i faith. Gobineau was a racist. He propounded this theory of the superiority of the white race and so on. Now, but this was not, you know, you can't transfer this to the modern context. Now, this was not intellectually disreputable at that time. I mean, this was not, you know, people wouldn't have been shocked. Well, sure, yeah, you know, this makes sense. I mean, look what we have civilization here, and look what's going on in Africa and so on. So it was a very natural idea. Now, what is an ideology? What do I mean by an ideology? Well, maybe I'll even write this on the board. An ideology, not that I write terribly well on the board, an ideology is any philosophy, which holds that certain ideas are superior to human beings. Any ideas, I don't care what the ideas are. So that's my definition, if you will, of an ideology. An ideology is the belief that certain ideas are superior to human beings. Now, we can all agree that there are good ideas and bad ideas. There are true ideas and false ideas. There are helpful ideas and hurtful ideas. There are pernicious ideas and dynamic, progressive ideas. But here I'm not talking about the value of the ideas. I'm talking about the meta-belief. I'm talking about beliefs about ideas, not the ideas themselves. Ideas are beliefs about reality. I'm talking about a second order belief. I'm talking about a belief about beliefs. I'm talking about then the belief or the concept that some set of ideas is superior to human beings. Now, once you accede to such a philosophy, it therefore becomes permissible to sacrifice human beings for the propagation of those ideas. And that is exactly contrary to true religion. Because true religion is not an ideology, as we will see. Religion is not an ideology. If we treat it as an ideology, then we have made it into something that it isn't. The Baha'i faith is not an ideology. Now, let me make it clear. I'm not saying that true religion does not have ideas or ideals. Clearly the Baha'i faith does. I mean, we have the ideal of the oneness of mankind, equality of men and women, and so on. I'm not saying that religion doesn't have ideals, ideas, a philosophy, if you will. But I'm saying that religion does not hold that any of these ideals or ideas is superior to the human being. Well, what is true religion then? Well, Baha'u'llah tells us, it's in the Gleanings. He says that the highest thing in creation is the human being. Baha'u'llah gives a strict order of creation, and then a tablet which is not yet published, but which I have a copy, and I've given a copy to Gordon, and so on, and he may have shared it with others of you, which is fine. Abdu'l-Bahá elaborates this much further. There is a hierarchy of values in reality. There's a hierarchy of values. The highest thing in existence is, of course, God, the essence of God. It is the one uncaused thing. And Abdu'l-Bahá tells us that the first thing created by God is the primal will, or the Holy Spirit, if you will. And it is this primal will that becomes incarnate in the manifestations. And the manifestations are, of course, human beings. They are special human beings. They are perfect human beings, but they are human beings. And everything proceeds from there. In other words, there is, I have to continue that here, there is a hierarchy, there is a structure. But in the gleanings, Baha'u'llah says, first you recall he says that God created all things. He rescued from the abyss of ultimate extinction all things, nothing less than his power and might could have possibly accomplished this, and so on. And then he says that everything in creation reflects some attribute of God. Everything in creation, he says, reflects some attribute of God. But he said, the human reality, the reality of the human soul, is that it has the capacity to reflect all of the attributes of God. And then he says, alone among all created things hath man been singled out for so great a favor, so enduring a bounty. You know this passage, okay? Alone among all created things hath man been singled out for so great of bounty. So this is a logical definition of the human reality. In other words, suppose we eventually did actually meet creatures from another planet who physically were completely different from us. But suppose they were obviously intelligent, we could communicate with them and whatever else. And we'd say, well, are these human beings or not? Well, I mean, we have here, in the writings of the Baha'i Faith, a definition of the human reality which is totally independent of the physical world. He says, the reality of the human soul, the human reality, is that unique reality which has the capacity to reflect all of the attributes of God. Nothing else in creation, nothing else in creation has all of this. So you can see that any idea or any collection of ideas can only reflect some of the attributes of God. So clearly any human being who has the potential of reflecting all the attributes of God is going to be superior to any idea or any collection of ideas. Now, I'm not talking about here the idea of the human in the mind of God. I'm not talking about the human being as he exists potentially as conceived in the essence of God. You see, Abdu'l-Bahá explains to us that there is no differentiation on the level of the essence of God. There is no differentiation on the level of the essence of God. So it's like, if you will, that God is like the sun. God is like the sun. And the different attributes of God are like the rays of the sun. And if we follow the rays back to their point of origin, they become one. They become indistinguishable. They meet at the point of origin. So at the point of origin, which is the essence of God, there is no differentiation. Truth, beauty, goodness are identically the same thing. Or another way you can look at it is that the sun generates a pure white light. Now, the pure white light contains all of the spectrum of colors. So I'm comparing the spectrum of colors to the various differentiated attributes of God. Goodness, justice, love, mercy, so on. Okay? So you cannot tell that all of these differentiated colors are part of the white light that comes from the sun until this light becomes incident on some lower reality. If I shine a white light on itself, what will I get? What will I get? White light. White on white is white. So, if I shine the pure white light of the attributes of God on the attributes of God, this is the love of God for himself that Abdu'l-Bahá talks about. Peres talks when he talks about the four kinds of love. The love of God for his own essence. So this is the shining of this white light on itself. This is a dynamic process, but which is wholly internal to the essence of God. So there is no differentiation on the level of the light itself. In other words, intrinsically the light is one. There is no differentiation within the light itself. The differentiation only appears when the light becomes incident on a lower reality, such as on a physical prism, in which case the prism reflects the spectrum of attributes. So, we see that every individual created thing absorbs some light and reflects others. Why does this appear to be blue? Well, you all know that. Why does this appear to be blue? Because the pigment, which is a physical substance in this cloth, absorbs all the colors of the spectrum except the blue part. And it reflects the blue back, and therefore you see only the blue when you see this. So the blueness comes from two things. It comes from the fact that the light is white, that it contains all the colors of the spectrum, and that this physical substance absorbs all of the spectrum except the blue. Okay? This is the physics of color. So this is like Baha'u'llah saying that every created thing reflects a specific attribute of God. This reflects the blueness. Okay? And her shirt reflects the pinkness, and so on and so on. But the human being alone in all created things has the capacity to reflect all of the attributes of God. So the human reality is like what? Well, the image that Baha'u'llah uses again and again, Abdu'l-Bahá uses, is the mirror. A mirror is, a perfect mirror, is a physical substance which absorbs no light. In other words, if it's a perfect mirror, which of course physically doesn't exist, an absolutely perfect mirror, but we can construct approximations to it, but an ideal mirror reflects all of the light that comes on, right? It doesn't absorb any of it.